4:30 being here, we'll get the call this meeting to order. Today's meeting, we don't have a quorum yet, so we'll get started with the presentation. It's by the Med Council, and whenever you're ready, you can proceed, and please introduce yourself for the tape and go forward from there.
Mr. Chair, it's a pleasure to be with you today to provide a brief overview of the Metropolitan Council and the services that the council provides. I'll attempt to be somewhat brief in the presentation, and I'll be very open to entertaining any questions throughout my presentation. To my right is Judge Shetman, who heads up our Government Affairs Division of the Council as well. And with that, perhaps I'll just go right into the presentation.
Did you introduce yourself then, too? Or?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Peter Bell. I'm terribly sorry, Mr. Chair. Peter Bell, Chair of the Council.
Thank you.
The first slide, which I think you have copies of, is the overview of the Council's mission. The mission of the Council is to develop, in cooperation with local communities, a comprehensive regional planning framework focused on transportation, wastewater, parks, and aviation systems. As you are aware, Mr. Chair, we have statutory responsibility for those four systems that guides the efficient growth of the metropolitan area. The Council operates transit and wastewater services and administers housing and other grant programs. And throughout the presentation, Mr. Chair, I will go into the various aspects of the Council that are embedded in this mission statement. Next slide. We are 17 members appointed by the governor and serve at the pleasure of the governor. Service on the council does require Senate confirmation. 16 members represent geographic districts across the region, and then I serve at large. The flow chart on the overhead is of the council. You see I serve as chair. Tom Weaver is the regional administrator of the council. And the lines of demarcation between the two is I have responsibility for the development and implementation of council policy and also provide oversight. And Mr. Weaver really is a chief operating officer and runs the day-to-day operations of the council. You can see that we have three major divisions of the council: community development, environmental services, and transportation. And then in each of those three, community development, you can see we have four activities: our livable communities grant program, housing and redevelopment authority. It's the largest HRA in the state. We have about 5,600 Section 8 certificates. They do all the land planning, which was really what the original function of the council was, and run all of our parks activities. In environmental services, Mr. Chair, you can see it's divided into two areas: the development of our wastewater system, or building out our system with our interceptor pipes, and then we also treat the wastewater at 8 treatment plants across the region. And then our transportation is divided into two categories: Metropolitan Transportation Services and Metro Transit, and I will go into detail of that in a minute. Our unified operating budget for fiscal year 09 is $750 million. This is our operating budget, not our capital budget. We also have a very, very large capital budget, over $1 billion in outstanding debt. For operating, there are it's $750 million. And you can see what the sources and uses of those funds are. We do have a property tax levy, Mr. Chair. We levy about $70 million in property taxes on an annual basis. From our wastewater system, we raise about $209 million from two sources, what's called a SAC charge or a hookup charge to our wastewater system. And then we have also, Mr. Chair, a flow charge, which is to process our wastewater.
One second, Mr. Chair. Chairman Bell. Now we have quorum. I'd like to officially call the meeting to order. And we'll do the minutes later. Okay. Right. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. From the federal government, we have $88 million in pass-through funds. We anticipate the use of about $20 million in reserves in fiscal year, the fiscal year we're in now, 09. Passenger fares for our transit system, we have $102 million. Local sources, we have $44 million and other at $9 million, and we get $208 million from the state, much of that from the general fund. Our uses, Mr. Chair, are, as you can see, debt service at $150 million, transportation and environment, I won't go through it all, community development, pass-through grants, metro transit, and regional administration. That gives you a snapshot of both the sources and the uses of the council's operating budget. Our staff complement, you can see, in 01, we had 3,800 employees. That has steadily been going down to 07. And then in fiscal year 08 and 09, it is calendar year 08 and 09, it has gone up. And the reason for the increase from the low of 3,577 to 3,763 is primarily resulting from the introduction of new rail service, the Central Corridor, the Hiawatha Line and the Central Corridor as well. We are staffing them for that, and North Star Commuter Rail Service. Those three rail projects are the primary driver from going from 3,577 employees in calendar year 07 to 3,763 in 08. Our footprint, Mr. Chair, is the 7-county metropolitan area, and you can see it on the overhead. One slight deviation from that is we will be providing North Star Commuter Rail service outside the 7-county area. It will be our first activity outside the 7-county area. And I meet with twice a year representatives from the, what's called the collar counties to discuss issues of mutual interest. One of the things that we are in the very beginning stages of exploring is perhaps developing some park and ride facilities in some of the collar counties. Our statutory responsibilities and planning, the council is 40 years old, and it started off as a land planning agency. Every 10 years, the 189 municipalities in 7 counties have to develop a long-range comprehensive plan and of where they really want to grow and develop, and that has to be consistent with the build-out of our infrastructure in those four areas of wastewater, parks, aviation, and transportation. And we are in that 10th year right now. In December of 2008, the 189 units of government were to have submitted their comprehensive plans to us for review. We didn't get all 189 in. That did significantly better than the previous 10-year period. I think we had about 100 that have come in and another 60 that have requested extension. This is just about double the number that was done in the previous cycle 10 years earlier. We also do a regional transportation plan. We do a regional transportation policy plan every 4 years. We've just completed that. And we do the planning for the regional parks. There's 10 implementing agencies, but we do the land planning for that system as well. We have statutory responsibilities for operations as well, Mr. Chair, in three areas. Our regional wastewater system, we process the wastewater for about 108 of the 189 municipalities in the 7-county area and our eight treatment plants. We run the regional transit system with the exception of the suburban transit providers, but we, through our metro transit, provide 82 million rides as of last year. We also run our contract for our metro mobility services, and then we run a number of what's called community transit programs as well. And as I mentioned a minute ago, we run the, what I'm told is the largest HRA in the state, and provide 5,900 Section 8 certificates for 99 cities in the 7-county area. And that's primarily in the 3rd, 4th, and Ring suburbs. Regional planning, just a word or two on that, because many people, it's a confusing and complex subject. This is really kind of the flow chart of our regional planning, those comp plans that need to be done every 10 years. They are based upon a development guide that the Metropolitan Council establishes. It is important to note, Mr. Chair, we don't do that in the dead of night. It's a fairly inclusive and transparent and participatory process where we develop this development guide and look at where what our principles are really for development in the 7-county area. We take those core principles for development in the 7-county area and we develop what's known as systems plans and systems statements. Those plans and statements are for, again, those four areas: aviation, wastewater, parks, and transportation. And that just adds more meat to the bones to the development guide. The development guide establishes the principles. The systems plans and statements really says with some degree of specificity where we're going to build our wastewater treatment system, where we're going to build that system out, where we're going to put new transit lines, where roads will be developed, where we envision putting new parks and the like. That's embedded in those systems plans and system statements. And Mr. Chair, that also is a very transparent and very inclusive process with all of the municipalities and the counties participating. Once we have those systems plans and system statements, then the local units of government are to develop their growth plans that are consistent with those systems plans and statements so that they match up. So we're not talking about running wastewater facilities where there's no growth. Or we're not talking about building roads where there's going to be no growth. Where we're not talking about placing parks where there's going to be no population. We want them to be matched up as closely as possible. We review those plans every 10 years or when the municipality is going to be making a major departure from their previous plan. And then local officials, we have to adopt and approve that plan before they can do any zoning. So broadly speaking, that's the flow of the planning process at the Metropolitan Council. And quite candidly, it's one that I think has served this region relatively well. The Metropolitan Development Guide, there are three principles to work collaboratively with regional partners to accommodate growth, to enhance transportation choices and increase travel safety and efficiency, and to preserve vital natural area and resources for future generations. Our systems plans and statements, the council prepared 3 systems plans. One of the things we did when I came to the council was put together transportation and aviation. Historically, they have been separated. We put them into one, and then wastewater and parks. Each local community receives a customized, and this is a new innovation, receives a customized system statement that details the relationship of each system to their community. So those 189 units of government get a customized statement of where roads are going to go in their municipality, what we're planning on doing wastewater in their municipality, a transit, aviation, parks, and the like. This is never a surprise to them, though, because they participate in the process really from beginning to end. It's a very interactive process that we go through. Community development functions are to administer the Land Planning Act, which really this is based on, provide planning data to local communities, including growth forecasts and population estimates. We have a department that just looks at that. And Mr. Chair, that's where we came up with the estimate that the 7-county metropolitan area, which has little over 2.7 million is going to grow to 3.7 by 2030, to identify and analyze a number of regional issues, to guide the regional parks and open space system. We do not operate the park system. We do the planning for the parks. We provide about 50% of the capital budget for the parks and about 10% of the operating budget for the parks. They deliver rental assistance program through the HRA, and they implement the Livable Communities Act. The local comprehensive plan updates, I've mentioned, the communities must update those plans by the end of last year, December 31st of 2008. Plans for 103 communities were submitted. I mentioned a minute ago it was around 100 communities, and extensions for submittal in 2009 were granted to 80 communities. We're still chasing down the other nine. local comprehensive plans, we provide a local planning handbook. We provide ongoing technical assistance through our sector rep program. We have sector reps that work with, in the 16 districts of the council, we have sector reps for each of those, and voluntary review of local plans during 2008. Mr. Chair, we also had a grant program for small communities where we provided them grants, particularly if the municipality didn't have staff to do a comprehensive plan. We provided them some grant dollars. I believe we had $1 million that we set aside for that activity. In our Livable Communities program, Mr. Chair, we have three grant programs in there. The Tax-Based Revitalization Program, it is called TIBRA. It has about $4 million in that program, and we provide that to municipalities to clean up polluted sites. The theory being is that they can clean up polluted sites, economic development can take place on that site, and that enhances or increases the tax base of that municipality, which is the rationale for the name of that. The second is our Livable Communities Demonstration Account. We have about $8 million on an annual basis that we distribute in that account, and that goes principally, Mr. Chair, to provide gap financing for development projects that, broadly speaking, adhere to Met Council principles. Multi-use development along transit corridors is what those dollars go for. Part of that, the third bullet is our local housing incentives account, about $1.5 million we have in that. And we do a collaborative effort with the Twin City Family Housing Fund and the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. We put about $1.5 million in that program on an annual basis. I have initiated a new fund, or I've taken, really what I've done is taken some of the dollars that were not expended in the Livable Communities Demonstration Account, and I started a land acquisition for affordable new development account. And this is a revolving loan fund for local municipalities that would borrow dollars from the Met Council at zero interest rate. They could then acquire a piece of land in their municipality that would be targeted for affordable housing. They would hold that piece of land for a 3-year, 5-year, 7-year period of time, and then as land values hopefully continue to go up at some point, they will have purchased the land at today's prices, hold the land 5 years, it'll be at a higher price, and that will provide them negotiating leverage for a developer who then comes to them and says, I'd like to develop that parcel of land. They can give them the land at today's value, and the quid pro quo is that the developer will make some of the units affordable. It's another arrow in the quiver of a local municipality. Next slide, please. The Livable Communities account, we have provided $87 million, and it has leveraged $4.9 billion in investments since the program was started. The local housing incentives account, we've got $24 million, and that has leveraged $510 million in residential development. That's the $1.5 million that we do on an annual basis. And the tax-based revitalization account is we have allocated $77 million, and that has leveraged $4.3 billion. And the new land initiative is $3.6 million for land acquisition. But as I indicated, we have just started that project recently. Mr. Chair, you can see the operating budget for the Community Development Division in 2009 was $9.8 million. And I won't go through all the sources and uses in the interest of time, but you can see where we secure dollars for the Community Development Division and then what the uses are as well. Next area is our regional park system. The Metropolitan Council identifies land and grant funds to cities, counties, and special parks districts which acquire, develop, and manage parkland that together with state parks and trails serves the metro area and visitors. Once again, we do the planning in concert with 10 implementing agencies that actually operate the parks. Mr. Chair, we do not operate the parks. We simply do the planning and then fund much of the capital for land acquisition. In our parks plan, we have currently have about 53,000 acres of parkland, and as you can see on the slide, 31,000 in 1974. There are 49 regional parks and park reserves within this that embody this 53,000 acres and six special recreational features. Como Park would be an example. We have 28 regional trails, 177 miles currently. We plan to increase that to about 877 miles. And we have 33 million visitors on an annual basis. Mr. Chair, we do an annual survey of our regional park system, or we do an annual survey of the seven county area, and we find the amenity that the citizens in the seven county area enjoy the most is our regional park system. And one of the things I always like to say is it is one of the truly, truly bipartisan things that the public enjoys. I always say liberals like parks, conservatives like parks, Democrats, independent, Republicans, everybody likes and utilizes the parks. It is truly a bipartisan endeavor. I have yet to meet anyone who doesn't like them or don't think that that's a valuable asset to the region. You can see on the map where our regional parks are located in the seven county area. And we, as in our plan, are going to increase the space from the land from 53,000 acres of parkland to 70,000 acres. On the next slide, I won't go through all the names, but these are the 10 implementing agencies that actually operate the park. It's a rather strange phenomena. For instance, Mr. Chair, we do all the planning for transportation and operate transit. We do all the planning for parks, but we don't operate the parks. So it's and they do, let me assure you, a great job in operating our park system. The council's role is to create public policy, designate parkland as regional, review and improve the master plans for the parks, and prepare and partially finance park capital improvement programs. The council issues bonds to match state and other funds for capital grants. So the state, Mr. Chair, does some bonding, and then we use our bonding authority to match the state bonds on a 60-40 basis. And this is used for, when I say capital, we're really talking about four things. We're talking about land acquisition, we're talking about building construction, we're talking about building renovation, and we're talking about land reclamation. And then finally, I see there's a question, Mr. Chair. We provide pass-through funding for about 10% of the operational budget for the park.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Scalzi, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much for the presentation. I've been getting emails recently regarding the new dedicated funding monies that are anticipated coming in beginning after July of 2009. And the governor's recommendation regarding that new sales tax money is, I think it's 36% to 38% for metro regional parks. I could be wrong on that. I just don't know the exact number. But the emails that I'm getting from constituents are telling me that two-thirds of the sales tax money comes from the metro area, and they're a little concerned that this 36% or 38% is not equitable with the fact that two-thirds of that money will be coming from the metro area. And I guess I'm wondering, since there's 33 million visits, and one thing I'm thinking is going to happen with the downturn and with the recession is that we're going to have more and more usage of these metro regional parks because people will not be able to afford leaving home for their recreational activities. I'm just a little concerned about the use of that money, and I'm wondering if the Metropolitan Council is going to take a position on that proposed rate of funding, and have you looked at this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scalzi, thank you for that question. It's a very important one. The 3/8 cent constitutional amendment that was just passed, as you know, is to be used for a number of different things. Wetlands is one, arts is another, parks is another, and habitat is still another. The administration is quite likely to make a recommendation and weigh in on this, but as you well know, the legislature is going to be empowered to actually make that decision. The Met Council will be most concerned and interested in the part of those dollars that are going to be designated for parks. And we have had discussions with DNR about what the allocation for that should be, the park side, not the art side or the wetlands and the like, but what the allocated amount for the parks will be. And we haven't come to a firm decision on that, but in candor, we are looking at, in the range for the park portion of that, about 38% to 40% of that would go to Greater Minnesota, 38% or 40% of that would come to the Twin Cities area, and then having a fund of about 20% to 24% that could go to one of three places. It could go to the 7 county regional parks, those 10 implementing agencies and the like, or it could go to Greater Minnesota for the state park system, or that 20% could go to regional parks that are in the collar counties, that any three entity could apply for that. We felt that it would be advisable to have some flexibility because you might have some major projects in the Twin Cities area where we might want to go beyond that 38% to 40%. Conversely, Greater Minnesota, the DNR might need 1 year or 2 years to go beyond that as well. And that band of regional parks that are in the collar counties would be able to participate only in that 20%. That's what we are tentatively, and I want to stress that, looking at, but the decision's really going to be in your hands. We think it's advisable that we weigh in, and that we give you the benefit of our thinking, but it's really principally going to be your decision. So that's where we're at with that at this stage for the parks portion of that 3/8 cents. One other thing that I want to add very quickly, and it's a fear that I have, and that is the provision in the constitutional amendment that does not allow us to supplant existing activities. My big fear is this, that given the $4.8 billion budget shortfall that's likely to grow with the February forecast, I fear we could have a scenario where we're defunding some existing park activities that the public and all of us might agree are a higher priority, and then using the proceeds from the 3/8 cent to fund lower priority things because of the inability to supplant. And I think the public would be concerned if they, understand that scenario is not implausible, that's a very real scenario that we can look at, because I think we're going to have a significant pressure. As I indicated, we provide 10% of the operating budget for the local park, and we're going to be proposing to the Parks Implementing Agency, the administration is going to be proposing a 10% cut. And in statute, that's supposed to be at 40%. We're only providing about 10.5% now, and it's supposed to be 40, and we're looking like we're going to take it out. So that's, I'm giving you more of an answer than perhaps you asked, with some of my concerns there.
Representative Scalzi.
And just as a follow-up, you're correct, because the Metro Regional Parks are a state park, and we're supposed to have been funded 40% and are currently funded at 10, so the other remaining shortfall is funded with property taxes and with admission fees, et cetera. And it's getting to be kind of a property tax burden to those communities that have to fulfill that shortfall. And I just want to make sure that we keep recognizing that it is an increase in the property tax burden to a state park system. Thank you.
Before you proceed, anyone else that has any other questions, as they come up and you've got them, feel free to raise your hand and we'll get them posed. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next thing I'd like to speak about briefly is a new regional park foundation that we're in the process of setting up. Last year, we received statutory authority from the legislature to set up a regional park foundation. Actually, in law, the Metropolitan Council is categorized as a municipality, and municipalities have to get statutory authority to set up a foundation. Because of the concerns that I had of moving from 53,000 acres of parkland to 70,000 acres, 177 miles of trails to 877 miles of trails, and the budget pressure we feel, I thought it might be advisable to set up a regional parks foundation. We have spent a lot of work this year doing all of the legal work to set it up. It has been established now. We're having our first board meeting this month. We are in the process of hiring an executive director for that, the purpose of which is to go to both the philanthropic community, individuals of means, and the general public to solicit funds for our regional park system. I don't present this as a magic bullet that's going to resolve all of our funding concerns, but I think it will move the park's agenda forward in a hopefully meaningful way. The next area I want to cover briefly is environmental services, Mr. Chair, touching on three areas: our wastewater systems plan, which essentially says where we're going to be building out our wastewater system, our wastewater services, which of course is just processing a wastewater, and we also have received statutory authority a couple of years ago to do water supply planning. You will note when I said we have four systems: aviation, park, wastewater, and transportation. Water is not one of them, one of the four systems. Yet and still, Mr. Chair, water, I believe, is a regional asset. Where Community A gets their water affects Community B. And while we are not Atlanta or New Mexico where they have severe water shortages, we felt it was useful to do some thinking and some planning around water safety and water availability. And so we got authority from the legislature to look at planning issues there. Our wastewater system plan,
Chairman Bell. Yes. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Chairman Bell, and I really appreciate your raising the issue of water supply if it's not a regional system, I do think it should be for the very reason that you mentioned. But I know that Representative Graffalo and I had sponsored the legislation that you referenced, and it I think, required a study of some kind, and I'm wondering if you might be able to briefly discuss, you know, the end result of that study and where it, what directions it points the Met Council to in terms of the future of water planning in the region. I think that given the million people coming, you know, there's increasing evidence of, you know, the aquifer slowly being depleted, maybe not at the rate of Las Vegas, but it is a serious issue for us as well. And so I'm interested in your thoughts about that and what that study concluded.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, we are just finishing up our study now, and we are going to be making a report to the legislature regarding that study. It does show very briefly that there are some pockets of concern in the seven-county area in terms of tapping into the aquifer. We are going to, the long and the short of it is provide enhanced information to communities about where they are accessing their water from and the impact that has. In point of fact, while water is not a system in the comprehensive plan, municipalities have to submit to us a water use strategy, where they're going to get their water from. Now, if push came to shove, because it's not a system, if we said, no, that's a bad idea, they could say, well, we're going to do it anyhow, and we really have no enforcement power. But we don't anticipate that. We are collecting much more comprehensive data on the aquifer, the impacts of tapping into the aquifer, and we'll be providing guidance to municipalities as they not only do their comp plans but update their comp plans on how that if the sources of water that they're going attempting to use, given the anticipated growth that they plan for, if that will create additional problems. The specifics of which we will be providing the legislature, because we're almost through with the report and what our recommendations will be.
Very quickly, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Representative Horton.
So, Mr. Chair and Chair Bell, will we be able to look at this report even this session, is it your thought, or is it going to be sometime maybe in the summer or fall?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, we were really planning on completing this this summer. Though I can talk to staff about doing a preliminary presentation this session. We can do that. Let me make that commitment. We can do that.
Thank you very much.
Representative Kalin. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chairman Bell, kind of piggybacking on Representative Hornstein's train of thought there, I think we'll get into the unique status of the county that I represent, Chisago County, relation with my council in a few minutes here. On the water issue and economic competitiveness has really come to the fore, using one project as an example. Michael Foods, which is currently in downtown Minneapolis, I can't remember if it's the Twin Stadium or the Gopher Stadium that has landlocked. I think it's actually the Gopher Stadium, and now needs to move to a new location. They've been looking at North Branch, where the sewer and water infrastructure impact just for them, including the first time that I can remember the council even talking about it, offering a 0% loan and financing as a $5 million impact for them. The other options are Chaska and Eau Claire. I think they're still struggling to figure out the wastewater issue down in Chaska because of capacity issues, mm-hmm. and we risk losing them to Eau Claire or Menominee. I can't remember which. In which case, I mean, this doesn't become a Met Council or a metropolitan issue, because currently, I think 70% of the potatoes for their facility are Minnesota-grown potatoes. If they go to Eau Claire, that center of gravity will change so significantly that it'll switch to 30%. So everywhere from Representative Saylor to Coonan to the Iowa border will be affected by that change. I just wonder if you could talk about the impact of wastewater and capacity issues in our economic competitiveness, especially on industries like this one.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, I appreciate that comment, because I have worked with, and staff has worked with, Michael Foods regarding this for the benefit of the other members of the committee. What the representative is talking about is that when a business is attempting or thinking about moving there are what's called FAC charges or hookup charges that accompany that. In essence, they have to pay for the wastewater that, or the increased wastewater capacity that they, that might be required as a result of their presence there. And, we were approached to see if there's anything that we could do. There's always fear of precedent setting issues that if we were to waive it, for instance, then of course everyone would come to us wanting a waiver of that. And so, we did modify our program to allow for an interest-free loan, as you indicated, that would make it less onerous and burdensome to them. I think it is fair to say that this was only one of a whole range of considerations that Michael's Foods was using in determining where they could wanted to locate. We just didn't want to be, we wanted to be a part of the solution, not a further impediment. It is my understanding that they have not made a decision as yet where they're going to locate, and this is one of the considerations. But we spent a fair amount of time in the council thinking about this and trying to come up with what I would term as a middle ground, common sense solution that wouldn't burden them with these SAC charges all at once, but allow them to be spread over time at really at a zero interest rate. Mr. Weaver, do you know if a decision has been made as yet?
I don't.
Yeah, I don't think it has.
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair and Chairman Bell, I appreciate that, and I know that the conversations that the council has had with Michael Foods very much mirrors the Chisago County and North Branch struggles. I'm sorry that my friend Representative Biskins isn't here today to note that the impact of a full tax abatement would be nothing compared to the impact of actually having the infrastructure in place to be economically competitive. It's that more often than not we see infrastructure, especially water and sewer. I'm sorry, Representative Hornstein, but regardless of how we might expand gambling a little bit, and I think that we're going to get closer to Las Vegas on the water than we are in the gambling this year.
Representative, or Chairman Bell.
Yes. Our wastewater system, you can see we have 7 treatment plants. We're going to be building one in Hastings. 600 miles of regional interceptors. Those are those huge pipes that you may see being put in the earth from time to time. It has an estimated replacement value of $3 billion. It serves 104 communities and processes approximately 300 million gallons of wastewater on a daily basis. This is a self-sustaining system that does not take any tax dollars to run it. Primarily, the capital to expand the system is based upon those SAC charges of which we were referring to a minute ago, and to process the wastewater it is through what's called flow charges, and those flow charges are made to the municipality, and the municipality passes it on to their citizens, and usually you'll see it on your water bill. That's really where it shows up, but we don't send a bill to individual citizens, the municipality does, and again, oftentimes it shows up there. Sometimes they upcharge it as well, which is a small point of irritation, but that aside. A couple of points to recognize is there's 2 years of perfect compliance with wastewater effluent permits. A facility is recognized for outstanding performance by the U.S. EPA, Minnesota PCA, the National Association of Clean Water Agencies. A couple of major initiatives are inflow and infiltration. This essentially means that we had clear water, Mr. Chair, coming into our wastewater system. Cracks in the pipe, in our wastewater pipe, sump pumps being directly put in. Some municipalities at one time had their rainwater going right into our pipes. What the long and short of that is that we are processing millions of gallons of wastewater that don't need to be processed. And when you do that, you have to either build more pipes or build more plants or more likely do both. and we decided the most cost-effective way was to stop it at the source point. And so we worked with all of our partners who were a part of our system and asked them to engage in a program that they would underwrite to take care of the I&I, that inflow and infiltration, the clear water coming into the system at their municipality. And we have been extremely successful in getting them to do that, even though it was a cost to them, because they realized if we had to take on the cost, the only thing we could do is build more wastewater pipes and build more plants. It was a major project. Bill Moore and his staff did an excellent job of coming up with this, working with the municipalities, and implementing it. It's really one of the quiet successes of our environmental division. Reducing wastewater or energy consumption by 15%, we are one of the largest users of electricity in the state of Minnesota. We all have a stake on our reducing the cost to run our plants. And then the water supply planning was another major initiative. The final one that isn't on the slide, but I'll mention, is the legislature allocated $500,000 to us last year to do a project with the University of Minnesota. And that project was to look at growing algae, high oil content algae, in our wastewater system, and to explore the feasibility of taking that algae, which grows particularly well in our wastewater, and helps clean our wastewater, and extracting that and converting it into a biodiesel fuel. The legislature thought it was promising enough last session to provide us $500,000 to partner with the university and seeing if we can bring that to scale, and we're in the midst of doing that now. The potential for that speaks for itself. It's very exciting.
Chairman Bell, where are we at with that? Will there be a report or an interim report or something, status later on in the session? Or
I don't know what the reporting mechanism for that is. Mm-hmm. We can provide, I'll make a commitment right here mm-hmm. to provide you updated information on that. Because it is, really the question is, can we bring it to scale?
Yeah.
We know we can do it. It's the whole issue, can you grow enough, extract it in a cost-efficient way, is really what the project is and the project to do. We will provide you an update in this session.
Thank you.
We're actually doing the testing right now.
Oh, yeah. Judd was informing me we're doing the testing right now, so. The environmental services budget for 2009 was $203 million. That's on the operating side, not on the capital side, and you can see where those dollars go to. You can see the comparison of where our for utility comparisons, where wastewater is relatively cheap at $16, and perhaps more importantly and more instructive, as you can see what our rate comparisons are across the United States. Not only do we have a system that is exceedingly effective, it is also very efficient, and that is evidenced by the comparatively low rates of our system on a nationwide basis. Our capital budget is you can see between 2009 and 2016, $1.3 billion, and it is just a little less is to expand the system, and a little bit more, slightly more, is the ongoing upkeep and maintenance of our system, which of course is exceedingly expensive as well. And we bond, of course, for all of this. Transportation, this is probably what we are known most for. We are the MPO, the Metropolitan Planning Organization. We perform federal and state mandated planning, including long-range transportation policy planning, and we coordinate planning activities with our sister organization, MnDOT, the Suburban Transit Providers, the Metropolitan Airports Commission, local governments, and the public. We provide, contract for, and coordinate metropolitan transit services. and we provide financial assistance to local transit providers. Our transportation policy plan, which we just completed, we updated every 4 years, touches on highways. It was approved this year. We're planning our 2010 amendment to incorporate federal reauthorization, the new highway bill, and other work. There's a possibility we would have to do that with the stimulus package as well, though I doubt it. We have responsibility to deal with highways, transit, airports, freight, and pedestrian and bicyclists. Our priorities for highways, this has caused some consternation, but is to preserve and manage the existing system, bridge replacement and repair, implement low-cost, high-yield projects, to reassess expansion projects from 2004 Transportation Policy Plan, and to develop a metropolitan highway system investment strategy, and this is with MnDOT for our 2010 amendment. Transit is our goal is to double transit ridership by 2030. It is to grow at 50% by 2020. To grow and strengthen our core bus system. And Mr. Chair, while we are all excited about new transit ways, it is important for committee members to understand that the bulk of our passengers use our bus system. That's the workhorse of our transit system, and it's something that often gets lost in the shuffle about how critically important it is, and to build a system of regional transit ways. In our transportation policy plan, it is to complete construction or final design, and you can see we have 6 corridors that have either been completed or in final design. That's a term of art from the FTA, but they are the 394 Hot Lanes, the Cedar Avenue Bus Rapid Transit, Hiawatha, of course, has completed the 35W BRT. Both the Cedar Avenue BRT and the 35W BRT are funded with an urban partnership grant of $133 million from the federal government. Central Corridor LRT, we are in preliminary engineering on that. We are making our application to go into final design. We'll be in that second phase for a year, and then we will make an application for a full funding grant agreement, where the feds would pay half of the $915 million cost of the project. And the North Star Commuter Rail line is scheduled to open in November of this year. So that's a new system that we will be bringing online. Develop as LRT, busways, BRT, or commuter rail. I won't go through all of those, but those are in our transportation plan. Develop as arterial street BRT, another listing of 9 potential transit ways, and plans for express, bus, and intermodal hubs, really at 2 spots. One is in downtown St. Paul at the Union Depot. The second is in downtown Minneapolis at the new Twins ballpark. Our 2030 transit system plan, our capital assumptions result in our being able to complete the Central Corridor by 2014. We're on schedule for that. 3 additional LRTs by 2030, 1 completed by 2020. Our friends at the Southwest Corridor would like us to expedite that and do that by 2015. Quite candidly, I think that's a little aggressive. But they are moving expeditiously to that end. The second started before 2020 and completed soon after, and the third completed by 2030. 1 additional commuter rail line, that's in addition to North Star, 4 highway BRTs, and 9 ulterior BRTs as well. One of the things that's important to note is that last bullet, which is that we think that when we anticipate existing sources of capital, we will be able to build all these. I am not nearly as confident as of us having the operational funding for all of those. Another way of saying that is we have a structural imbalance in this region where transit capital is on a much firmer footing than transit operations. Transit operations, about 38% of it is funded through the motor vehicle sales tax, which is anything but a stable source of funding. And that's going to present a major challenge for us. Transit progress, Hiawatha LRT opened in 04. Ridership exceeds the 2030 projections. As I mentioned, North Star is going to open this November, perhaps December. Central Corridor completed preliminary engineering, and we're just wrapping that up. Planning construction to start in 2010 and opening in 2014. And the urban partnership agreement, the $133 million I spoke about a minute ago, in 2009. Other areas of progress, the Southwest Transit Way completed alternative analysis and is beginning the environmental impact statement. That's EIS. The Red Rock Corridor has completed their alternatives analysis in Botno and Rushline corridors. Botno Boulevard is Highway 61 from Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn. Oh, you're very familiar with it. Of course you are. What am I saying? Coming into to downtown Minneapolis and the Rush Line corridor as well. This is our map. Everyone's got to have a map. This is ours. The red lines are completed corridors or in final design. The candy cane ones, this was much more appropriate around Christmas time, but the candy cane lanes show what we are in the process of developing, and those can be bus LRT, busways, BRT, or commuter rail. And that will be based upon studies and available resources. The blue lines will be developed as arterial street BRT, and the yellow as express bus. So that is what is currently in our transportation policy plan. Our regional transit system, and I'll be brief with this given our time, there are a number of components to it. Metro Transit is by far the largest component. As I mentioned earlier in my presentation, Mr. Chair, last year it carried 82 million passengers. Suburban transit providers, they were formerly known as the opt-outs, they either provide their own service or contract with us to provide service. We acquire all of the capital for them, though, so we buy their buses and the like. Contracted regular route services, that's where it doesn't make sense for us to run Metro Transit, but we may contract with another provider. Metro mobility is an important component of our transit system that we fund and funded through the private providers providing it, but if the funding comes from us, from the federal government. Community-based programs, we spend over $3 million a year on community-based programs of one sort or another. These are very small transit providers, and primarily in the rural part of the seven-county region. Van pools and regular car pools are also a part of our system. Our current situation, everyone knows it. It doesn't really bear repeating. Congestion is a problem that's growing. There's fuel price uncertainty. There's increasing environmental sensitivity and the recognition, I would argue, across the political spectrum, that transit is a piece of the puzzle in addressing it. Commuters are seeking alternatives for their commutes, and demand for transit is growing, and the MVEST revenue source is a challenge.
Chairman Bell, Representative Turner, you had a question?
Yes, Chair. I just had a question regarding the Suburban Transit Authority. How many riders would you estimate those systems or the formerly opt-out carriers provide rides for?
Chair Bell?
I am just told there are about 10 and 12 million that they provide on an annual basis.
Okay, thank you.
The whole system provides about 93 million rides a year for the entire region. So it's very, one point of reference there, I was just at a conference. Utah, the greater Utah area, has a population slightly smaller than ours, 2 million people. We're 2.7 million, and they're at 39 million rides. We are 2.7 million, and for region-wide system rides, have over 90 million rides. Now, you can prove anything with an anecdote, but it's, I think it goes to the point that our transit system is well utilized. Transit ridership is increasing.
Mayor Bell, yes. Representative Eastman, you had a question?
Yeah, I was just wondering, when you start talking about 94 million rides, and that could be, how does that translate into the number of people that actually use transit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, that's a harder figure, and I think that an important point embedded in that is these are not 94 million separate individuals. These are 94 million rides that are provided. Obviously, most of them are the number of actual people that use transit is much less than that. To get a figure on the number of people that are actually taking those 92 million rides is harder to arrive at. I can will state, though, that the transit provides a slightly less than 5% of the rides for the commuting public in the Twin Cities area. But the actual number of riders, I don't know. Do you know the answer?
We can
get that for you. I don't have it here.
With one way for one person.
Oh yeah. If somebody takes transit every day, that's 5 days a week. That's 10 rides. So I don't want to mislead folks to say we got 92 separate. And we couldn't have that. We're only 2.7 million. So obviously we couldn't have that. But I wanted it's an important point and a useful point.
Representative Chairman Bell?
Our regional bus system, 84 million, that's more than just Metro Transit. That's up 5.9 million. It's the highest in 27 years. For Metro Transit, for regional transit, it's the highest ridership. And I'm separating regional transit from Metro Transit. Metro Transit is our biggest transit provider, but not our only transit provider. In our entire system, Metro Mobility, community providers, suburban transit providers, it's the highest ridership in 51 years. Hiawatha, on an annual basis for 2008, was 10 million rides. That's up 12%. And our fare box recovery rate, incidentally, on rail is upwards of 40%. Which is an important figure. Next slide. Regional park and ride usage is up 16% over the last 2 years. Most park and ride lots are full. I always say if you don't get there by 8 in the morning, you're not going to get a spot. Since I've been at the council, we've increased our park and ride capacity significantly. You can see we're at 25,000 park and ride spaces, which is an increase of 111%. Since 1999. When I came to the council 6 years ago, we had 15,000 park and ride spots and have increased it significantly. So park and ride number of spots and usage is up. Our budget, $883 million. This is our operating budget on a calendar year. You can see where we get our sources of funds from. MVEST, passenger fares, the federal government, use of reserves, local sources of funding, and the state general fund. That's where our sources come from, and then you can see clearly stated where our dollars are allocated to. Metro Transit, again, the largest transit.
Representative Eastman.
I have another question. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chairman Bell. Am I putting the logic together correctly here? If we have 94 million rides, and we're looking at roughly passenger fares are making up a fourth of the costs, roughly, It looks like the cost is, if you just do the rough math, is 94 into 383, roughly a little over $4. Can you speak to that issue? Am I seeing that right? Are we basically subsidizing 3/4 of the cost with state funds, federal funds, and all the other funds that we're talking about here on the operational side? Plus we have all the capital expenditures besides. Is that kind of the picture? And then along with that, what is the capacity? Where are we running in terms of the capacity of the systems that we have in place now? Are we running at half? Are we running at a fourth? Are we running at 3/4? Are we going to see this relationship change? Or you commented earlier that the operating budget is the area that's the toughest to deal with. So just could you comment a little bit about those things?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, I think that those are very important and fair questions. And your analysis, to the extent to which I understood the question, if I don't, please correct me. It is about a fourth of the dollar, the cost to run our transit system comes from the passenger, his or herself. Now that varies system to system. As I indicated earlier, the rail system pays about 40% of the cost on one end of that continuum. Metro mobility is probably 10% of the cost at the other end of the continuum. So that 1/4 is a blended rate, taking dial-a-ride services, community providers, the suburban transit providers, rail, bus, metro mobility, and when you blend it all together, you get that the rider, his or herself, is paying 25 cents roughly on the dollar. But there's vast differences in between that. To your question of do I envision that changing much in the foreseeable future, regrettably no. I think this is too low. I wish that more of the cost of transit was coming from the rider, his or herself. But I think it's important to note that a third of our customers are what we call transit dependent. That means they don't have a car or they can't operate a car. Our system really disproportionately serves low-income populations. And so when we look at fares and fare box recovery, it needs to be balanced with that as well. And I think the other aspect of this is that I think it is a good thing to relieve congestion and to get people out of their cars. I think this is a positive thing. And so I think that the positive social aspects of that can make an argument for some degree of subsidy. That's in the eyes of the beholder of is it too much or too little. I wish we were getting more from the fare box. I don't envision that changing much in the foreseeable future. And the third question was capacity and how much underutilization do we have in our system that we can fill up. And quite candidly, that's uneven as well. There are some buses that you will get on and you can't get a seat, that they are just jam-packed. And there are other buses at different routes and different times of the day where there is unused capacity. Over the past 6 years, we have been wringing out some of that capacity. When we've had budget challenges in the recent past and have done what we called restructuring routes, which is a fancy name for cutting routes, the first routes that are on the chopping block, of course, are those that where there's vacant seats, which is what you would hope and anticipate that we would do. But we have to be careful with this because we need a system that provides regional balance and is a true system. And to provide that regional balance and that full system, there has to be, in my judgment, some, and again, this is in the eye of the beholder, some tolerance for inefficiency. And you can't just say we're just going to run the number 16 bus and the number 5 bus, which are always packed, and not go to other parts of the region. And so it's a balancing act. But to answer succinctly, yes, I wish the fare box recovery rate was higher. No, I don't think it's going to change appreciably in the future. And we have been wringing out excess capacity in our system over the years. But we can always do more of it. And I think you can anticipate we will.
Representative Turner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just was wondering, have you thought of ideas how to maybe raise that fare box a little bit higher without disenfranchising the transit riders that maybe don't have the ability to pay the fair share of the ride?
Mr. Chair, Representative Turner, we constantly are discussing our fare policies and our fare structure. As you may know, we just increased fares that took effect October 7th. Roughly speaking, a 25-cent increase, and we tweaked things and other parts of our fare structure. It yielded about $7 million. Roughly speaking, though, you do not get a dollar-for-dollar benefit. In other words, if you raise fares a dollar, you will not collect a dollar because you get a drop-off in ridership. Actually, it's about a 70% return because you get a drop-off in ridership as a result. We will look at fares again. It isn't my top priority because we just did it in October. I don't want to cut routes. I don't want to reduce fares. But we are looking at dealing with our operational deficit that stands now, the biannual deficit of $45 million, with a combination of things. We're fairly well reserved. We get block grants from the federal government that we can allocate more to operations and less to capital. There are a number of other things that we're thinking about doing. But fare increases are not off the table, but they're not number one on my priority list.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, have you ever looked at or compared the cost or the subsidy we do for highways? You know, the drivers don't pay the full fare of what it costs. Have you ever done comparisons with that, with the subsidies that that you do with MetTransit?
Mr. Chair, that is an excellent question. There have been, I believe, doctoral theses written on comparing this. I have not been able to wrestle that question to the ground other than to say this. Car users, automobile users get subsidy, transit users get subsidy. Having said that, it is fair to say the transit users get more of a subsidy than those that use a personal automobile. But it really, the answer to your question really determines on what the inputs are, how you factor in externalities. Are you going to factor in the impact on the environment as one of those factors? And then if you do that, how you tease that out, you really get into some difficult discussions. And so I have never in 6 years been able to wrestle that firmly to the ground other than to state unequivocally, each gets subsidies. But the transit user in candor, I know, gets more subsidy per passenger, per ride, than the driver in the automobile. There's no, in my judgment, no serious debate. Now, how far that is, reasonable people will argue.
Thank you. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad that Chairman Bell gave some clarification of the comment, because I've heard that bromide thrown out a lot of times, never with the supporting documentation. I'd love to have a full and open hearing on the assertion you just made a few moments ago on what all is entailed in that at some point. But that's not my question. It just happened you threw it out, and I thought I'd throw in a comment. I want to talk about North Star and about Hiawatha for a moment, if I may.
Sure.
Unless it's been spoken about. The ridership, I know we used to, when I was on the transit board, Mr. Chairman, we did about 33% we like to get to. Are we trying to hold that on the light rail and the North Star as well? And while you're commenting on it, let me talk about the ticketing of affair or procedure for Hiawatha. It's pretty much the honor system, frankly. Are we going to do the same thing with North Star? Or how is that going to be priced and collected? And I guess the first question was, where are we at with ratios on the rail side of transit ridership? For
Chairman Bell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, the ratio, if I understand you correctly, is the fare box recovery that we're getting. Rail on Hiawatha, we are close to 40% with our fare box recovery rate. It is the highest part of our system, with the possible exception of if you were to take, for example, the 16 bus that goes down University Avenue. The fare box recovery rate, I haven't looked at it, but it's probably higher than that because the costs are much lower. The number 5 bus, the fare box recovery rate is much higher. Our bus transit system is under 30%, but it's very close to that. And as I indicated earlier, Metro Mobility and the like is below that. We do have an honor system in our for Hiawatha, where you purchase a ticket and then you have to show that on demand. And the theory behind that is we wanted to make sure that our fee collection mechanism did not cost more than the incremental increase of the fees that that you collected. And we estimate, though we are really wrestling this to the ground, to be able to state, and we're auditing this actually, to state with precision what that fare box compliance is. Right now we're looking at around the mid-90s for that, but we're auditing that. Mr. Weaver and I have wanted to make sure that was, when we say 95%, that we can back that up. And so, is it 91? Okay. Mr. Shetman just told me it's 91%, but that we are looking at that. North Star, we are planning on doing the same thing, except we are going to have distance-based fares for North Star. It's something that is going to be new here. The top fare for a one-way pass on North Star, we are looking at, we haven't made a firm decision yet, but it will be $8 one way. And then it will, that's the highest, and then it will get less the closer you are to the 40-mile ride to coming in. And we're going to experience distance-based fares in other commuter sheds as well. It's a yield question. We want to get that fare box recovery rate as high as we can, and we want to be fair to the customer. And the customer has to perceive value that is cheaper than auto insurance and gas and running their car, and it's more convenient. And so we're always, you know, judging that.
Thank you.
Proceed, Mr.
All right. I was talking, I think we've done that. Can we go to the next slide? That's our North Star commuter rail line. Our Go Greener initiative is a major initiative. We've ordered 53 hybrid buses that have 22% better mileage and half the emissions. 45 of them have arrived. Ordered 252 diesel buses with cleanest burning engines. 87 of those have arrived. We are burning anywhere between 2 and 10% of biodiesel in the winter, and 2 and 20% in the summer. One problem we have encountered, however, is that the biodiesel that we run in the winter gums up our filters. And so we are likely to be at the lower end of that range of 2 to 10% in the winter because of the operational concerns. In the summer, the burning of 20% biodiesel tends to work quite well. We also burn ultra-low sulfur fuel, and actually we created a market because we're the largest user of fuel in the country. We created the market for ultra-low sulfur fuel in the region.
Representative Kaler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and perhaps Mr. Shetman could skip back about 10 slides to the 2030 map. Or Chair Hausman would be proud of me if I called it the 2020 map. But
yeah.
you know, looking at the map, I know you've heard this concern before, but those of us in the East Metro get candy canes while the folks in the West Metro get meatloaf and full blood supply. And that inequity is of great concern for economic development purposes, for quality of life purposes, for regional and social balance. I would be abdicating my responsibility if I didn't raise that question, but I'd like to embed it in the larger question. I know that you and I had the pleasure of, I think actually moderated a Citizens League regionalism panel that was a great conversation, and Professor John Adams, I think, he certainly shocked me, actually, from the University of Minnesota when he described our region not as a 7-county region or a 13-county region, but a 25, did I have that number right? 25-county region. And as you know, in Chisago County, we are the 8th county in the 7-county metro region. We pay for we compete in the area transportation project process, same infrastructure dollars, and we still actually don't have a transit facility that can access the metro area in Chisago County. We had to make a sacrifice to help pass the bill, the transportation funding bill in 2008. Gladly made, better to have 7/8 of a loaf than to sit at home hungry, but we are underserving significant portions of the potential growth market for transit because of artificial boundaries that are 3 or 4 decades old. I think, rather than a comment, I'm sure that you'll have a comment back that I'll listen to very intently, so rather than ask a question, just I'll close my little comment by saying that I think we have to find a way to serve those areas, like, for instance, the route 288 bus route that started after the bridge fell down from Forest Lake into Minneapolis was standing room only at fares that I was shocked that were competitive. And even though the fares have gone up and the bridge is up, the bus is still, I think, 3/4 full all 4 times in the morning and all 4 times coming back. So clearly, we have a hungry population ready to jump on board transit. And as far as I know, it's the only way that we could reduce congestion 2%, 3%, 4%, 5%. If we build new roads, it doesn't work. So I'm curious about just your thoughts and your plan to find a way to expand beyond the jurisdiction without exceeding your legal authority.
Chairman Dell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, I think your points are very, very well taken. As you are aware, in our transportation policy plan, many echoed the comments that you've just articulated, and it resulted in our changing the plan to attempt to be more accommodating to the East Metro area. I have been very, very clear in conversations that I've had, and I just stated it a minute ago, that to have a transit system, you have to have regional balance. You just have to do that. And one region can't feel that they are dramatically shortchanged at the expense of another region. And while this is perhaps small comfort, the Central Corridor is the line that we are working on now. It is my number one a priority. Will reflect, it will be the largest public works project in the history of the state of Minnesota. Huge amounts of time and resources and energy are going into that. But you rightly, I think, point out that there needs to be as much regional balance as possible. But there are other forces at work that need to be addressed as well. When people, the indispensable ingredient with transit is density. And so when people ask for increased transit service, the question I always come back with is what is your current population, what is your current population density, and how do you envision that changing and growing? And the fact of the matter is that transit, this map, if we did an overlay, and you're giving me a good idea, perhaps I will do an overlay of density in the 7-county area. And I am convinced that there will be a very close tracing between where density exists in the 7-county area and what our transit plans are and where our transit systems are going. I think by and large people have received that well. To your question or to your point about services outside of the 7-county area, I have said that I think the 7-county area is an artificial boundary. We all know it is larger than this. I have also said that I will not initiate any plans to expand the jurisdiction of the Met Council beyond the seven counties. I think that that would create a great deal, a number of issues, a lot of consternation. Having said all of that, I would very much like to see the Met Council, and we are actively exploring this now, the Met Council doing one or two park and rides outside of the seven county area, maybe in Chisago County, where we provide express bus service with a park and ride lot. There's going to be a lot of complicating factors, getting statutory authority to operate outside of the seven county area, getting joint powers agreement for constructing the park and ride lot, dealing with the operational subsidy that transit requires, a whole range of issues. But I think that that is the kind of thing that we need to do in this, the citizens' demand.
Thank you. Quick follow-up.
I know we've got time.
I've got five more people who want to ask questions, and we've got 4 minutes left, so keep it.
Quick comment that we heard in energy just earlier today that the utilities are proposing integrated resource plans, and the Public Utilities Commission just responds to those, and that amounts to our energy planning in the state. I don't think we can just respond to density changes. I think in some ways we have to really say, where do we want to have responsible development in terms of the integrated infrastructure, and how do we plan transit along that path? But I know we'll continue this conversation. Appreciate it, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Bell. I'm glad that you concluded your presentation with a going greener slide. And I think that the Met Council, as a transit agency and one that deals with land use, is uniquely positioned to really have an impact, I think, on two public policy challenges we have. One, reduction of our dependence on foreign oil, and then reduction of greenhouse gas and other air pollutant emissions. I'm wondering if you have some thoughts about this connection between land use and transit. I know the Minnesota Climate Change Action Group did a study that, you know, the governor's appointees on that group, significant reduction in emissions and energy use through land use and transit changes. The University of Minnesota did a study released this past summer, same conclusion, very significant reductions. How do you feel that the Met Council can respond to that challenge?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, I think that that's a great question. You and I have discussed this in the past. First of all, to your point, does land use affect efficiency on a number of different levels, including energy consumption? I think it's beyond serious debate. I mean, that's somewhat of a settled question that, of course, if we build different ways, we will use energy with more or less efficiency. To the extent to which should the Met Council get involved with that, that primarily would be a legislative decision, that the legislature would decide to either give us the authority to do that or not. My instincts is to crawl before we walk and walk before we run, and that if the legislature wanted to move forward, that it would be in the way to ask us. You know, we ask for a number of things in the comprehensive plan that we do not have statutory authority over. Protecting vital natural areas is an example. We know what the vital natural areas are. We ask communities to plan around them. If they said, you know what, we don't want to do that, we couldn't enforce that. But there's a bit of peer pressure that comes about in the light. So my instincts are not to move that, elevate that to a system, but ask communities to plan for efficient use of energy, and then see where that takes us on a voluntary basis rather than one where it was coerced. That's what my instincts are. I need to add quite quickly, I haven't spoken to the governor about this, and so I don't know if he would say no. Or Peter, this is something we don't want to do. I think he would be more open to it, however, quite candidly, if it were voluntary rather than required.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Chair, Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bell, I've got a brother-in-law and a son-in-law that work for the MTC, so my son-in-law is a diesel mechanic, and he's been interested in the hybrid thing. So on the last slide here, I guess I'm kind of curious. Could you just, could you talk, I see you've got 53 hybrid buses, 252 diesel. What is the difference, essentially, in the efficiency between the hybrid and the clean diesel that you're looking at here in terms of efficiency? That's kind of one question. And then the other question, I guess, you made a comment earlier about you're the biggest fuel user, and you kind of spurred the low sulfur diesel. How many gallons of fuel do you burn a year in the end?
You know, I don't know. I can get you the exact number. Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Tammy Bell.
Representative Eastland, Mr. Shetman just told me, what is it?
It's about 8.5 million gallons, 8 to 9 million gallons of fuel a year.
It's what we burn. The hybrid electric buses, of course, are just that. They are hybrid buses that operate partially from electric power, and we use those in the city. The diesel buses are for more longer haul routes. But I can get you more specific information on the characteristics of each. That's no problem for us to do. We'll just pass it along to you. We'll ask to do that.
Representative Beard.
Mr. Chairman, I just was hearing Representative Kalin's angst as he pled for 2030 routes into Chisago. So speaking on behalf of Carver and Scott County, we'd be happy to donate our planned routes for 2030 to our friends at Chisago County.
Sold.
You may want to look at your map first, Representative Kalin.
Representative Hilty.
Well, Mr. Chair, I say that we're out of time, and I tried in my own committee to, and I appreciate your starting on time. I tried to end on time as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I would invite Chairman Bell to respond some other time to this, but you know, I look at the maps and all of the arrows are going out, and I've heard the term growth used a number of times. I look at the first page of the presentation and the council mission, and I think it's possible to read that as saying it is the mission of the Metropolitan Council to accommodate sprawl. I guess the question would be, we're envisioning an energy-constrained future, which I think is reasonable to do. Don't we want to have planning that contemplates greater concentration and greater density rather than further and further outreach to accommodate sprawl?
Chairman Bell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, I will be brief in the interest of time. You might be interested to, I would challenge in part what you said. I would say we want to facilitate orderly, efficient growth. As the population grows, you want to be able to accommodate that in an orderly, efficient way, which is, to some respects, some would say another word for density. We actually are consuming less acreage on an annual basis than we have in the past. Right now, we're consuming about 7,200 acres of land per year, whereas in the 90s, we were at about 9,500 acres of land that we were consuming per year. The Twin Cities is densifying. Minneapolis and St. Paul are some of the few Frost Belt cities that have actually seen population growth. 50% of all the housing that is being constructed, which is very little, is attached housing. And so our region, in some respects, is redensifying. Now, I don't interpret that to mean that there will be no outward growth, because I think that we have to balance many of the issues that you're talking about with the rights of citizens to do largely what they want to do, and for municipalities to grow and develop the way they want to grow and develop. And I think the Met Council, I've always said, is where two civic values kind of come together. And one is efficient use of scarce resources, good stewards of the environment. These are all laudable goals and ones that we should take seriously. They have to be balanced against, however, the rights of municipalities and citizens to have a fair degree of freedom and choice in where they want to live and raise a family and the like. And the Met Council tries to kind of reconcile, in many respects, those two civic values. I guess I would leave it to others to say if we're doing it well or not, but I'm always have that kind of, I'm always thinking about that tension. And I think the Met Council gets in trouble when it errs too far on one side or too far on the other side. And I think any Met Council chair will always, or hopefully a Met Council chair, will try to strike a balance between those two.
Thank you. Representative Phil Sterner.
I'll make it quick, Chair. Thank you. What are your thoughts of the current, or just the transit taxing district? Thoughts of that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sterner, my personal belief is that the transit taxing district should encompass the full seven counties. What the debate is, first of all, I think that this is an issue of tax equity more than a real revenue source, because it just doesn't raise that much revenue. I think the governor, who has expressed some ambivalence about this whole issue, would be more comfortable if the tax itself wasn't raised, but the amount was spread across the full seven counties, rather than the folks that are paying it now would be taxed at a new at that rate. I suspect there'll be some efforts to that end in this legislative session. I think the governor doesn't have a strong stake in the ground, but has expressed to me a preference for if we did anything, and he hasn't signed on to that. I want to be clear: if anything was done, it would be spreading the existing tax burden to everyone in the seven county rather than raising it.
Representative Sterner, did you have an opportunity to read the minutes?
I did. Thank you, Chair. I've thoroughly reviewed the minutes of that, and they're just exquisitely prepared. And so I so move it, Mr. Chair.
All in favor of the minutes from the previous meeting?
Aye.
Opposed? Yes. Ayes have it. Meeting adjourned.